You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When Great Britain ended its rule over India in 1947, it petitioned it along religious lines to also create a new Islamic nation, Pakistan, which now has the second largest Muslim population in the world. 12.5 million people were displaced, and up to 1 million died in the aftermath of that partition. And in the years since, Pakistan and India have been in continuous conflict. Pakistan has also been beset by internal ethnic, religious, and political struggles, and the activities of militant and terrorist groups have made it one of the world's most unstable nations. Yet, despite all of its vulnerabilities, Pakistan has seen tremendous economic growth. In his new book, Instant City, Life and Death in Karachi, NPR Steve Inskeep uses that southern city as a lens through which to explore the consequences of rapid urban expansion and its impact on Pakistan's stability. His book is published by the Penguin Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Steve Inskeep to our studios today. Hello.
Oh, it's an honor to be here. Thanks very much, Leonard.
Every so often, you disappear from your anchor chair at Morning Edition. Was it to work on this book?
In several cases, yes. I took a little bit of time off. I've been going back and forth to Pakistan, sometimes working for NPR, but sometimes going on my own to work on this project.
And do you rely on translators?
Well, you have to. I mean, there are a lot of different languages spoken in Pakistan, which is one of the most amazing things about the country. English is very prevalent. It is the language of a lot of official business. There's also Urdu, but every province has its own language, and there are even local languages, and they all come to bear in a city like Karachi because, like New York, it's a city of migrants, of immigrants, people from all over the country and beyond.
And many of them came as a result of the partition.
Many of them did, and people have continued coming. And this is one of those places that I feel touches on so many huge news stories, one of which has to do with migration. People are coming from the war zones up near Afghanistan.
Still, wasn't Karachi, which you call an instant city, already an important urban area before partition?
It certainly was not. It was moderately important. It was a provincial capital, but it was a few hundred thousand people, about 400,000.
But it was a working seaport.
It was a seaport. It had not even been a provincial capital until a few years before. It was the most significant city inside the new nation of Pakistan, and it became the capital of Pakistan, but it had not been that much of a city before.
So you say 300,000 people now, 13
well over
to 15 million.
Take your pick. The most conservative estimate would be 13. There's a census that may show it to be considerably more.
So why did it become a magnet after 1947?
Because of the same reasons that other cities around the world have become magnets. Now, it was a special case somewhat in Pakistan because you had this partition that you mentioned. This was a majority Hindu city in 1947. And when this Muslim nation was created, the majority of the Hindus were driven out or fled to India. At the same time, though, hundreds of thousands of Muslims, refugees, came from the Indian side, and the city began to grow explosively. After that, though, it became, as so many cities in the developing world are, a magnet for opportunity. We see these cities often as being dangerous and dirty and disastrous and disorganized, and they are. But people come because they see opportunity there.
When Pakistan was created, it was actually a divided country, an eastern and a western side.
Yeah.
The eastern side is now Bangladesh. Was there a similar migration to Dhaka after partition?
Dhaka was not a very significant city at all in 1947, and it has grown to be somewhat in the league of Karachi as far as size. So there certainly has been migration, but actually one of the significant migrations in South Asia has been from Bangladesh to Pakistan, and in fact, there's a huge Bengali community in Karachi these days.
How much of the migration is from rural areas to urban areas like Karachi?
Oh, that's really large, and that's something that you can see happening in China today, something that you can see happening in Brazil, any number of other places, and that happened in the United States once upon a time.
But because Karachi is a banking center and
it's a banking center, it's a port, it's an industrial center. There are textile mills where you can get a job. There are steel mills where you can get a job. There are government jobs. It's a provincial capital still today. And also the very growth of a city like this creates more jobs.
But it was also the capital of Pakistan. Why was the capital moved to Islamabad?
Well, this is a city that has been chaotic from the early days of the country of Pakistan. It was the first capital from 1947 to 1958. In 1958, there was the first of many military coups. And anybody who's followed any history in Pakistan is aware that there have been coup after coup after coup in this country. This coup was by a general named Ayub Khan, who had a lot of opinions, one of them being that Karachi was a hot, unpleasant, unhealthy city full of protesters in the streets. It was roiling even then. It's certainly violent even today. And he didn't want the government to be in reach of those protesters. And so they dragged the government up near the military headquarters of the country. And Islamabad is not very far from where the military headquarters is now, the new capital.
Well, the military plays such an important role in the politics of Pakistan, but also the business of Pakistan. So I would have thought it still would have wanted to stay close to the business center.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that. The military remains there. And that's something to understand about Karachi, which is also true, as we've learned this year, in Egypt and Turkey and other places. The military in Pakistan, in addition to their political clout, their intelligence agencies, and the guns, of course, that they have, and the nuclear weapons, they are big into business. And they are huge landowners in a city where, like New York, land means everything.
Does that go back to the beginnings of Pakistan?
I think
it sounds kind of like socialism, but not socialism.
It actually goes back. Before that, the British had traditions like this, and even the ancient Romans had a tradition of giving soldiers a farm. That was their pension. You'd get a little bit of land. And the Army of Pakistan began doing the same thing, but people realized they could grab bits of underpriced land, resell them, and become real estate developers.
When partition occurred, India already had something of a government in place. Pakistan had to start from scratch, didn't it?
Yeah.
Was that one of the problems?
Yeah, absolutely. You had this new capital of a new country, and they didn't have any of the infrastructure. I mean, anybody who's studied the history knows that the British controlled all of South Asia. They did have this colonial infrastructure to run the place, and all of that virtually was inherited by India. Pakistan was carved out and carved away, and so they had to start from scratch.
Was India willing to help?
Not very much.
Britain?
I mean, no. Well, I mean, the British attempted to help. The Indians were reluctant to see the partition at all, and anybody who when you get into it, you realize that, for example, the Indians refused to give the Pakistanis their share of the national bank funds for a while, central bank funds. The British tried to help. In the end, though, the Pakistanis went casting around for allies and persuaded the United States by the 50s that Pakistan could be a super, super ally against the communists, the Soviet Union.
Also, India was seen as leaning toward the Soviet bloc.
Yeah, without a doubt. And John Foster Dulles, Secretary of State in the 50s, went around looking for allies, was rebuffed practically by India, was welcomed by the Pakistanis, who ended up getting hundreds of millions of dollars, even then, in 1950s dollars, in military aid out of the United States.
Well, I've seen a number of documentaries in which young Pakistanis are asked about their opinions about the United States, and they're all very hostile. So do they have a short memory about this?
You know, I love that because in studying the history of this place, you can go back to 1958 and read American diplomatic cables in which it is said even then, this is a strongly anti-American place where the elite is kind of on our side, but we've got to figure out how to deal with the hostility to the United States. It's been there a long time, but at the same time, I think that there is it's more complicated. There is an awareness that Pakistan needs the United States, and there is also a great interest in the United States, and millions of Pakistanis have connections to the U.S. because so many have moved here.
My guest is Steve Inskeep. On top of his NPR duties, he's written a book called Instant City, Life and Death in Karachi. It's published by the Penguin Press. It's been said that the continued conflict in Pakistan is part of a struggle for national identity.
Mm-hmm.
Why has it been so difficult for Pakistan to achieve a sense of national identity?
Well, it starts with a really simple fact of names. India is India, and was able, simply because of the name and the landmass, to claim all the great traditions of India. Pakistan was a creation of the 20th century. Nobody had even thought of the name until the 20th century. The next thing was that it was supposed to be a homeland for Muslims. But that unity was always somewhat of an illusion. You have many different kinds of Muslims. You had, at the beginning, a country with a great diversity of religions, with millions of Hindus on the Muslim side of the lines. You also had many different ethnic groups, many languages spoken. It is hard to construct a nation from scratch, and they've struggled to do that.
And we've been hearing about attacks on Shiites and Sufis in Pakistan,
yeah,
by the Sunni majority?
Yeah. This is, I think, really important to understand. It is, in my mind, the backstory to a lot of the news that we hear that seems incomprehensible about terrorism in the country. And it's the fact that among the violence, and in fact, perhaps the most prevalent violence, is Muslims killing other Muslims. It is a battle within Islam and within this country for power and dominance within the country. And it has less to do with the West, although we're clearly involved, than it does with the dynamics inside Pakistan.
But in the other countries where this seems to be a problem, we usually find a minority group running a country, Bahrain, for example,
sure,
where
the
Sunni minority and a Shiite majority that complains that it's been oppressed. We saw something similar in Iraq and elsewhere. But in the case of Pakistan, the Sunni are the majority. Why are some, obviously not everybody, but why are some terrorist groups still going after Sufis, some of the most peace-loving people in the world, or Shiites?
This is also useful to know, because if you wonder, where did al-Qaeda come from? Where did radical Islam come from? One of the many sources of it is South Asia, where there has always been an incredible religious diversity. Sufis themselves are so diverse, it's very difficult to even get a one-sentence definition of what they are. It's a mystical brand of Islam, and there are many different variations on it. There are Shias. There are other religions as well, Christians, Hindus, Zoroastrians, this ancient Persian faith that is older than Islam. And in past centuries, conservative Sunni Muslim clerics, mostly Sunni Muslim clerics, became greatly concerned that all these other religions and all these people who strayed from their view of conventional Islam were polluting the faith and endangering the faith. And they began reacting and responding, and their ideology was passed down to some of the early leading voices in Pakistan.
And this is not limited to Pakistan or some of the other countries. I did a show in which we talked about Shiites, and I got an email from a listener who said, why are you calling Shiites Muslims? They are heretics.
Yeah. I mean, I spent time in Karachi, and this is one of the incredible ironies of Pakistan. I went and spent time with a leader of a banned group in Karachi that still operates in the open by just by another name. And part of their platform is the restoration of the caliphate, the leader of all the Muslim world. But another part of their political platform is that Shiites should be declared kafirs, should be declared apostates. That's a common, I think it's a minority sentiment. I think there's still an awful lot of tolerance in Pakistan, but it's a common sentiment in a certain segment of the population.
Didn't the country's founder, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, have a very inclusive vision for the country?
Oh, absolutely.
But he was also a Shiite.
He himself was a Shiite. I don't think a lot of people realize that. And as a matter of fact, the Bhutto family, who've been so incredibly influential in Pakistan through the years, also Shiites. But if you listen to someone like Vali Nasser, a great expert on the Muslim world, who's been observing Pakistan for years, he will point out that Benazir Bhutto, the late prime minister, the murdered prime minister, in the 90s had to begin kind of downplaying the Shiite side of her religion because the place was becoming more and more intolerant.
Now, Jinnah was a rival to Gandhi, but they also shared certain principles, didn't they? And like Gandhi, he died soon after partition. Is there a feeling that history might have been different if he'd lived longer?
Well, let's remember that 3 days before the independence of Pakistan, Muhammad Ali Jinnah gave a speech in the city of Karachi. And it's a rather moving speech in which he says that he believed that his fellow citizens should treat each other as equals regardless of color, caste, or creed. It was an essential thing for Jinnah to do, because here's a guy who actually at one point in his life married someone from another religion, was surrounded by Parsis, as they're called, Zoroastrians, was surrounded by Shiites because he was a Shiite, dealt with all kinds of different people, and knew that his new capital, which he'd chosen, his hometown, was at that moment a majority Hindu city. The Hindus were the elites. He knew that he needed every kind of person in order for Pakistan to succeed. And he called for that in that moment. And that is a speech that Pakistanis still remember today. But of course, that promise, that proposal was violated almost immediately. And a lot of Pakistan's history is the struggle between those two views of the world.
My guest is Steve Inskeep, co-host of Morning Edition, the most widely heard radio news program in the United States. He's written a book called Instant City, Life and Death in Karachi, which is published by the Penguin Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Steve Inskeep. He's written a book called Instant City, Life and Death in Karachi, published by the Penguin Press. Much of the tension between India and Pakistan has been over Kashmir, hasn't it? We've been talking about other kinds of tensions. How important is Kashmir to the story?
It is hugely important. I am pleased and thrilled that this book is being published in South Asia. It's being published by Penguin India. But I was informed that there's a little map, which you'll find in the front there, Leonard. And it's just a little map of Pakistan. The map had to come out for the Indian edition because it assumes, it doesn't even have the word Kashmir, but it assumes in the outline of Pakistan that it includes the Pakistani-occupied portion of Kashmir. And the Indians don't want to see that on a map. So, I mean, it's still a really raw subject on both sides of the border. This was a province, as many people will know, that was disputed from the moment of the independence of Pakistan, a majority Muslim province that India claimed is now divided between the two of them, but it's not the only problem that they've had between the two of them, those two countries.
But it's pretty far from Karachi, as are the tribal areas, which are another flashpoint. Does that all spill into Karachi?
Oh, it absolutely does, because as we were discussing, this is a city of migrants. And when something goes wrong elsewhere in the country, one of the possible effects is that people come to Karachi. People are unable to find jobs in an area that is war-torn, and so they'll come to Karachi where there are jobs. And it might be a job, as I was talking with textile workers who are making $3, $4, $5 a day, and that for them was a great job and a lot more than they would make in other places. And there's opportunities for education if you can find a school that's open. There are things you can do in Karachi you can't do anywhere else in the country.
You can't talk about Pakistan without addressing its alleged ties to militant and terrorist groups.
No.
Why do many Pakistanis directly blame the United States for the spread of terrorism in their country?
That is complicated. This is a country that embraces conspiracy theories.
Why do you think that is?
I can't claim that they're a lot worse than other countries we could name. I mean, people have grabbed onto conspiracy theories in this country as well. But Musharraf Zaidi, who is a Pakistani newspaper columnist and development expert, had an interesting theory about why conspiracy theories are so very prevalent in Pakistan. And his theory was simply that there is not a credible government. You can never believe anything that the government says. The government is not effective in addressing people's problems. And as a result of that, I mean, a broken justice system, a sense that few crimes are ever properly solved, there's no truth. There's no basic truth. And in the absence of some credible version of reality, people begin to make up their own. And one of the versions of reality that has come up constantly is the following theory, that the terrorist attacks that are wrecking Pakistan, and there have been far more people killed in the last few years in Pakistan than Americans have been killed. The theory is that these attacks are instigated by the United States as part of an effort to destabilize Pakistan so the U.S. can have an excuse to come in and seize Pakistan's nuclear weapons.
It's odd that they share in common the feelings of people in this country who say 9/11 was an inside job.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's conspiracy theories everywhere in the world, and that's one thing I want to emphasize. I mean, some countries have more or less of a problem, but if anybody comes away from this book with anything, I hope that they sense that there are human beings on the other side of the world, and that there are people who, I mean, they're terrible people you'll find in Pakistan, and they're also heroic people that you'll find in Pakistan, and you'll find millions of people struggling to make a little better life.
How did the militant group see the Pakistani government?
The militant,
because we hear about ties and at the same time opposition.
That is really interesting and complicated. When I was in Pakistan earlier this year, the government confirmed that they believed they had killed a man named Ilyas Kashmiri. That was an alias. This is a guy who had been a Pakistani commando and was put to use training militant groups, which the government has used to fight its wars over Kashmir, which you mentioned. And, of course, the Taliban fits in this category.
Taliban have been encouraged by almost every Pakistani government.
Yes, indeed. Even governments that were relatively Western-leaning. I mean, they were formed in the 1990s when Benazir Bhutto, part of the time, was prime minister. Of course, she didn't have full control over foreign policy. That went to the military. In any case, the government has these ties with the militant groups, but what has happened in recent years is that the groups have grown increasingly out of the government's control and, in many cases, as we know, turned against the government.
Although we keep on hearing of ISI involvement in these things. Is the ISI pulling all the strings?
I don't think the ISI is pulling all the strings. I find it credible when Pakistani officials and people on the street describe a Frankenstein monster that they created but is now on the loose. I find that credible. I don't think they're pulling all the strings, but it's really hard to know. And I think that there are cases which we could discuss that make you wonder if the people at the top of the Pakistani military know entirely what all of their people are doing.
Yeah, well, it feels like this is a government at war with itself.
Could be.
For this book, you decided to focus on one specific attack in Karachi that took place in 2009. What happened and who were the targets there?
This, on December 28th, 2009, was a Shia Muslim procession. So we have a minority religious group going through the middle of the city, down Muhammad Ali Jinnah Road, named after the founder of Pakistan. The procession was bombed just as it approached the old city hall in the heart of the city. Quite a few people were killed. It was a tragedy, although it was also close to normal for Karachi, where Shias are killed a lot. It was just rare that so many would be killed in this way.
There were similar attacks, not all that much earlier.
Yeah, there have been similar attacks, absolutely. But what made this even more tragic was that after the bombing, men appeared on the streets. There's still controversy as to whom. And burned a substantial part of the commercial district of the city. Hundreds of wholesale stores and warehouses were burned, scorched or burned to the ground. And this led to tremendous political controversy in the city, tremendous conspiracy theories, as we were discussing in the city, and tremendous questions, political questions, about who would use the suddenly vacant land, because people are obsessed with real estate there.
So was that... the real cause for the burning, that there was land available suddenly?
I can't tell you that was the real cause for the
burning. Has anybody determined who was responsible?
No, and again, we get to what I was hearing from Musharraf Zaidi. It's hard to get to ground truth here. Everyone has a theory. The theory tends to blame one of the various political parties in Karachi, but it's hard to prove.
But you spoke to someone who said that the fires were all over land. There are illegal developers, the so-called land mafia.
Yeah, absolutely. There is no doubt about that part. That's out in the open. It's hard to say what happened in this specific incident on December 28th, but it points to the central role that the control of land plays in the city. And when you head out to the suburbs, when you radiate out from the center of Karachi, you find many, many square miles of theoretically public land, government land, that have been grabbed by developers who will slice it up into small home lots and sell those lots to the poor. They will sell land that they do not own and bribe police to look the other way.
And you talk about the prevalence of bribes paid by developers to proceed with construction. They're paying off the police, and are they paying off the military as well?
Oh, yeah, and that I thought was really fascinating. I felt like the market evolved during my different visits there. In 2008, I spoke with a guy who was building homes who described how the police would sometimes lock up his construction workers and you have to pay to get them out. But by 2010, when I was in some of these neighborhoods, it had clearly become a more regularized business. And you paid a bribe that translated to about 50-some dollars, U.S. dollars, per home lot, to the commander of the nearest police station, and then your home lot would be legal until he was transferred and another commander came in, and then you have to pay the bribe again.
My guest is Steve Inskeep. His book, Instant City, Life and Death in Karachi, is published by the Penguin Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. But I'm assuming this housing boom is in response to all of the people who are coming to the city. The alternative would be to have some of those tent cities that we see in other capitals.
Yeah, absolutely. This is something that is almost universal. It is not something that you just discover in Karachi. City after city around the developing world have millions of people living in informal neighborhoods, as they are called, illegal neighborhoods, if you want to use a harsher term. In any case, not regular, not regularized, not within the law. And some people defend them because at least they are providing homes for the poor.
But doesn't the government have any urban planning?
Yes. But it has not always meshed with human nature, and it has not always meshed with the planning of the city. I mean, I recount in here the story of one of the great urban planners of the 20th century, a guy who reshaped cities like Washington and Philadelphia in the 20th century. He was brought to Karachi to lay out suburbs in this city, and his plans were very interesting, but they were very quickly overwhelmed by events. You had people that just came in. They were put into houses, but the jobs were not close enough for them. People did not have cars in the numbers that they had in the United States. It made no sense for them, and people ended up moving back to their old neighborhoods. Then they moved factories out to the suburbs, but people would begin building illegal homes to live near the factories rather than going where the plans dictated. This is a city that in many instances has simply grown out of the control of the government.
And growing younger, isn't it? 58% of Pakistanis are under the age of 24.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing.
How many are they mostly educated?
No, not at all. It may be a little better than it used to be, but not a lot. This is a country where the illiteracy rate is more than 40%. Early in October, I went and spent some time in some schools in a difficult neighborhood in Karachi. Now, Karachi actually is more literate than most places. It's a place you go to get an education. There are universities. But in a rough neighborhood where there's violence between ethnic groups, violence between political parties, you will find government schools that are vacant and dust on the desks, desks stacked in a corner. I was in this one school where someone had chalked on the blackboard, apparently the last time anyone had been there, May 31, 2011. This was in October. And from what I could gather, even on that date, it may simply have been a teacher furtively going in to write the date so they wouldn't get fired for absenteeism. But it seemed that perhaps there had not been much school in that classroom for years.
But these kinds of inequities are what have led to a number of the uprisings in the so-called Arab Spring.
Yeah.
Are people in Pakistan aware of what's going on in the rest of the Muslim world?
Absolutely aware of that. And I do feel that in exploring this city that I've discovered the backstory to so many huge news stories. And when we're talking about the Arab Spring or we're talking about income inequality, as people are in this country, it is spectacularly on display in Karachi. It's become even more on display in Karachi. A lot of glass towers going up in the last few years. Pakistanis have suggested So from time to time that they're a little disappointed themselves as they watch the Arab Spring, because they actually had an uprising in 2007. They actually forced a military ruler, Pervez Musharraf, to give up power. But what has followed is years of increasing frustration, which frankly may be what follows in Egypt and some other places. We'll have to see.
What about Zia-ul-Haq? He died in a controversial helicopter crash. Do the conspiracy theorists believe that he was killed, that was a political assassination?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are many theories of this. One,
he was an awful man.
He was considered an awful man. He was an Islamist. He certainly is someone who was, let's say, in the most neutral way we can, influenced greatly what Pakistan is today, because he inserted Islam into politics, inserted Islam into the schools and into society in ways that it simply had not been before, and people often blame him for troubles. There's a great novel by Muhammad Hanif, A Case of Exploding Mangoes, that takes all the many conspiracy theories about how Zia-ul-Haq's plane must have gone down and assumes that all the conspiracy theories are simultaneously true. He's killed many times simultaneously by many different people, and that to me is classic, and it symbolizes the way people feel about that military ruler.
India is going through a major economic boom. Isn't Pakistan as well, although not as explosively.
From time to time, there's been dramatic growth. Here's one figure for you. In Karachi, around 2007, there were 545 more cars on the street every single day. Cars, trucks, motorcycles, and so forth. That's a couple hundred thousand in a year in one city. That is a sign of prosperity. It also turned out to be a sign of a bit of a bubble. The economy has struggled tremendously. Partly that's because of security concerns, because of terrorism. Partly it's because of governmental disorganization. They can't keep electricity on in the cities. There are blackouts every single day.
The current president, Asif al-Zardari, is the widower of Benazir Bhutto.
Mm-hmm.
And my sense is that there's widespread dissatisfaction, and yet we haven't seen a military coup in quite a while.
Well, define quite a while. hasn't been for a while. Over the summer, as things became a little more chaotic, there were people who spoke of one or even called for one. It hasn't happened. There is great dissatisfaction with Zardari. His supporters would say, of course there is. There are terrible troubles that the government is struggling with. But I want to say one thing, Leonard, that Pakistanis, a fair number of them, will say things like the following. I'm so dismayed with the situation. This is even a shameful government, they will say, but it must stay. We must keep it. We have to let the system work. Let them finish the five-year term, and at the end of 2012, beginning of 2013, we can have another election and see what happens then.
Because they want to maintain democratic institutions.
They've never gotten through a normal cycle where you elect a government, it does its five-year term, and you have a new election, and they're replaced. That has never happened.
You talked to many Pakistanis for this book, and they were from all socioeconomic backgrounds. Despite all of Karachi's troubles, you are relatively optimistic for the city.
A little bit, because of the fact that you have millions of people who have come to that city seeking a better life, seeking to better themselves. And they've done it with incredible ingenuity and perseverance. And so you want to believe that in the end they can succeed.
Do you think that if the Kashmiri situation were resolved, that many of these other problems would disappear, because the tension with India is the reason Pakistan gives for maintaining a scary nuclear arsenal. It has to spend a lot of money on the military, and it is also funding all of these secretive militant groups.
I do, and I don't think I'm saying anything that a lot of American experts or Pakistanis wouldn't tell you. Pakistan has so much potential. It has similar potential to India. Part of the reason that it can't enact that is because so much money is spent on the military, because you don't have full access to that huge Indian market, because you don't have the opportunities that you lose when you're at war. And if some of these tensions were cleared away, it would make a huge difference.
And many people blame India for the problem.
Of course they do. And many Indians blame Pakistan for the problem. It seems to be one of those things where it's almost some people in Pakistan will compare it to people who went through a bitter divorce, and it's just hard to get over it.
But still, at this point, couldn't it just be accepted as a fait accompli and let's move on, because it's being so destructive?
Oh, yeah. Well, if you just name Kashmir, I mean, there are ways to just put it under international supervision. There are proposals out there. The question is how you get there, particularly given the political dynamics of both places. Sometimes, if you get too close to a solution, what happens is that bombs start going off in ways that might have been designed to prevent any kind of solution.
When Steve Inskeep is not being co-host of Morning Edition, he seems to be traveling to Pakistan, or is that over now?
I may go back again. It's been very interesting there, but I'm traveling. I mean, I've been to Iran, I've been to Iraq, many places, and I don't know where I'll go next.
Instant City, Life and Death in Karachi is Steve Inskeep's book, published by the Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks, Leonard.